Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another exorable episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Coming up on today's podcast, we have an interview with Edward Sobel, Steppenwolf Theater's Director of New Play Development. You have to check out this interview. And also Chicago critic Tom Williams will be bringing you two more audio reviews. And of course, as always, Chicago's theater news. So sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another episode of Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of July 17th, 2006. The Pirate Queen is in final rehearsals and is getting ready for its world premiere that will be coming later this year here in Chicago. Creators of Riverdance will be bringing you The Pirate Queen as a big budget musical. And it is based, of course, on the real-life story of the legendary Irish clan leader, Grace O'Malley. As you may recall, she led quite an extraordinary life back there in the 16th century in Ireland. Well, now it's going to be a big Broadway play. The production, which is a cast of 40, is finishing up the show in Dublin, Ireland, and will be premiering it at Chicago's Cadillac Palace Theatre. Tony Award winner Frank Galati has been tapped as the director. Stephanie J. Block, who you may remember from Wicked, will be taking on the lead role of the Pirate Queen. Stay tuned to Talk Theatre for more information about tickets. Remy Bumpo Theatre Company will be celebrating its 10th year of producing talk-provoking plays by opening up their 2006-2007 season with Gore Vidal's The Best Man. Coming up after that will be Tom Stoppard's The Real Thing and George Bernard Shaw's Mrs. Warren's Profession. But to not only celebrate that, they will be launching a new project called Think Tank, which is a month-long studio series production that will be presented from March 15th through April 15th in 2007. Now, this will all be in the Victory Gardens Greenhouse Downstairs Studio Theater. For more information, head on over to Theater in Chicago's Theater News section to find out more in-depth information about Remy Bumpo's 10th season. It's gonna be a good one. The Color Purple is getting closer to Chicago. The producers of The Color Purple are currently holding auditions for the Tony Award-nominated show. The Color Purple will raise the curtains at the Cadillac Palace Theater in April of 2007. Now, this is going to be a long-run engagement, and the initial block of tickets are going on sale only through June 2007, so you need to get in and see this show. The Chicago run will also be followed by other engagements all around the country. And congratulations to Adam Fleming for joining the cast of Chicago's Wicked. Adam will be replacing Telly Long as Bach in the Stephen Schwartz hit musical. The show is running now at the Ford Center for the Performing Arts, aka the Oriental Theater, and has been sitting quite pretty for some time. Now, Adam Fleming has also starred as Sketch in Broadway's Hairspray. And as a little bit of trivia for those theater folks out there, Adam and I went to high school together, believe it or not. There are a lot of cultural events going around Chicago right now, and all of this has to do with the gay games that are currently in town. Now, as you may have noticed, the gay games are quite a to-do around town. And of course, the sketch comedy company Gayco couldn't be happier about it. You need to catch their show, 10 Years of Heresy, the best of Gayco, that is going to be running now through July 23rd at the Theater Building in Chicago. This is one of many of the cultural events surrounding the Gay Games. Don't miss it. Marriott Theater in Lincolnshire has said that their next summer hit will be Married Alive. It is a new musical about a couple of married people, and it was last seen at the American Heartland Theater in Kansas City.
Stay tuned to Talk Theater for more details.
Well, thank you very much for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Remember, you can find out more about these by going to talktheaterinchicago.com's Theater News section. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in those ears. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of The Unmentionables. The Unmentionables by Bruce Norris, directed by Anna D. Shapiro at Steppenwolf Theater. The Unmentionables is another gem from provocative playwright Bruce Norris. Bruce Norris and Steppenwolf Theater, in collaboration with director Anna D. Shapiro, have produced another terrific and quirky play that comes close to being as good as the 2005 Jeff Award-winning The Pain in the Itch by Bruce Norris. Unmentionables is full of biting humor, dazzling characters in a provocative story that reveals the contradictions inherent in human response to a crisis. Norris once again demonstrates his knack for blunt honesty in character development. Set in the tiny West African country in a posh villa owned by an American entrepreneur, outstanding set design by Todd Rosenthal. The Unmentionables is a look at people trying to find themselves in a foreign land. They come to Africa to either make a fortune while offering jobs to help develop the primitive African economy, or as Christian evangelists determined to feed and inspire the poor people toward self-determination. They are helped by a corrupt local government administrator and a hash-smoking native doctor employed by the American industrialist. Norris deftly paints a portrait of each by creating memorable characters whose quirkiness hides their hypocritical, contradictory attitudes toward Africa and its people. From the devout minister Dave, played by Leah Kosko, the youthful idealist and pure Christian fundamentalist threatens the cooperation and the status quo by stirring up his poor parishioners. His older ex-TV star fiance, Jane, played by Shannon Cochran, can't adjust to the primitive conditions of the mission and relishes her stay at the plush villa. Nancy, played by Amy Morton, is the flamboyant, obnoxious wife of the American entrepreneur who bursts into the set spouting complex anecdotes and long run-on stories in an I-me-my jibber-jabber that is quite funny. Morton steals many scenes with her goofiness. When Jane feigns sickness, the doctor, played by Ken E. Head, treats her with blunt objectivity. The commanding a native government official, Auntie Mimi, played by Ora Jones, is the American's friend and collaborator in keeping the status quo. Don, played by Rick Snyder, is the American industrialist bent on making everything seem okay, especially in the environment of his home. Much of the play is a series of humorous exchanges where Norris has his characters expounding their beliefs, principles, and motivations for being away from home and living in Africa. These folks have chosen to come to Africa to do good, either by stimulating the local economy or by religious and educational evangelism. They are hero wannabes. The native doctor, Ken Head, as a bluntly honest, detached doctor, who sees through the subtle arrogance of the Americans and asks, "Why come here? Couldn't you find no poor folks in your own country?" Norris suggests that Africa offers the platform necessary for making of heroes. We see how the local government uses harsh treatment, including torture, to maintain power. When Dave, the missionary, is apparently kidnapped by the rebels, Etienne, played by John Hill, a native teen and suspect rebel, is captured and interrogated by Auntie Mimi's military aides. We witness outstanding ensemble work, which is, of course, a Steppenwolf trademark, where comedic instincts work well with emotionally charged performances. We see the characters move from being very funny to being very emotional. Shannon Cochran and Rick Snyder were effective. Amy Morton was splendid, while Ora Jones owns her scenes. Ken E. Head landed much bittersweet humor beautifully. John Hill as the teen boy was scary. The crisis of having one of their own missing in a strange, hostile land brings out the true character as each American has to come to terms with their beliefs in the face of a crisis of survival. When threatened, do they abandon their principles to their own self-interest? The question becomes how to get the teen to confess to the kidnapping of Dave and to offer some information on where he is being held. After all, he did have Dave's cell phone, so therefore he must be a part of the plot. The Americans and Auntie Mimi must decide if torture is appropriate to gather the information necessary about Dave. Only the doctor refuses to participate in this crisis of conscience. We see true character emerge as the crisis plays out. Do principles win, or does basic survival pragmatism prevail? Norris smartly resolves the dilemma. You'll have to come see the play at Steppenwolf Theater to find the details. The Unmentionables is Bruce Norris' cautionary tale addressing how our actions says who we really are. This is an intelligent work worth your time. My rating on this show, recommended. It is at Steppenwolf Theater, 1650 North Halsted in Chicago. The running time is 2 hours 15 minutes with intermission. The play runs through August 27th. For more information about that and tickets in general, call the Steppenwolf box office at 312-335-1650. That's 312-335-1650. This is Tom Williams saying, go see a play this week. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Here's my review of Unchanging Love. Unchanging Love, based on Anton Chekhov's story In the Hollow, directed by Gillian Kelly at the Artistic Home in Chicago. Unchanging Love is a splendid trip into the 1920s Appalachian life. The Artistic Home mounts another terrific ensemble piece, Unchanging Love, sprinkles the work with Appalachian speech and several Appalachian songs, including Christian hymns, cute ditties, and marvelous three-part harmonies. While not a musical, the traditional country music added local color and a mood of the small town innocence and fundamentalism beliefs that the people in the small town have. Victor Doylina, Justine Serino, and Betsy Elizabeth Ann McKnight produced marvelous harmonies, and McKnight added several terrific solos that created the mood of the small town life in North Carolina in the 1920s. This is a harrowing story of innocence and compassion. We meet the Pittman family, who controls the general store and much of the commerce in their small town. The paternal leader of the Pittman clan is 75-year-old Benjamin Pittman, played by Gary Houston, in an emotionally wrenching turn. Benjamin Pittman wants his sons to assume the Pittman's place in the town. In order to do that and to perpetuate the family, they need children. His simpleton son, Avery, played by Peter Fitzsimmons, married Leanna, played by Tara Dunlap, who is a terrific businesswoman but can't have children. Enter Shelby Pittman, who is played by George Dixon, the oldest son, who lives and works in the state capital. He is prosperous and shares his wealth by passing out silver dollars to all of the family members. Shelby ends up marrying Judy Musgrove, who is the Betsy Elizabeth Ann McKnight character who does all the singing. They come from a poor sharecropper family. We see how Benjamin Pittman uses unethical practices such as overcharging customers, selling outdated food and short-weighting his customers, among other deceptions that helped him amass a small fortune. He imparts his corrupt methods to Shelby, who proceeds to commit counterfeiting of the silver dollars as a crime that lands him 6 years on the chain gang. Leanna Pittman schemes with Crutch, who's played by Mark Dillon, and Oates, who's played by Jason Almstrom, to have a brick factory built on the land she acquired for the Pittman family. Barbara Pittman, played by Ellen Kelly, is Benjamin's second wife. She befriends Judy and the newborn son of Shelby. She hates the fraudulent business practices of the Pittman family. She tries to get Benjamin to deed the newly acquired land to Tommy, who is the infant son of Judy and Shelby, as the first step toward changing the unethical business practices of the Pittman family. In a shocking ending, we see how, in rural life, families cover up events that could bring down the reigning family. This is a well-acted, nicely-paced drama, laced with folksy songs sung a cappella, including solos and rich three-part harmonies. This is a compelling family saga where greed, cruelty, and compassion clash with compassion and innocence. Gary Houston and Betsy Elizabeth Ann McKnight were terrific in this show. They get help from Evelyn Kelly, Peter Fitzsimmons, and Victor Doylina. Once again, Artistic Home proves that a small equity theater company can land polished productions, even minute venue. This is storefront theater at its very best. My recommendation for this show? Recommended. It is at the Artistic Home in Chicago, located at 1420 West Irving Park, right off Irving and Southport. The running time is 2 hours with intermission. The ticket price is $20 to $22. For more information, call the Artistic Home at 773-404-1100. That's 773-404-1100. This is Tom Williams, once more reminding you, go see a play this week. Thank you. This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is Ed Sobel, who is the director of new play development for Steppenwolf Theater. He is also the program director for Steppenwolf's second annual First Look Repertory of New Work. Hello, Ed.
Hello.
Tell us now what the First Look New Rep program is all about.
Sure. It's a program we started last year and have decided to make an annual event. It began really from the impulse. We had a few plays that we were very excited about, a couple that we commissioned, a couple that we had gotten in as submissions, either through agents or through the writers directly, that we felt, were beyond the point of what people would normally consider development, that they were not going to benefit from just having another reading with some actors, and that what we wanted to do was provide an opportunity for these writers and for these plays to move to a different kind or a different phase of their development.
So these are all new plays?
These are all brand new plays, yes. And so we initiated this program in which we continue to do development on the plays, but rather than it culminating in a staged reading or kind of workshop presentation, we have it culminate in an actual full production in rotating rep in our garage space.
Wow, that's terrific. Because, a lot of people are saying that Chicago is now the hotbed for new playwrights. And between what Chicago Dramatist is doing and Victory Gardens, to have you guys come and help develop it and actually produce it.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Steppenwolf has, has a history of producing new work. Generally
yes.
speaking, about half of what we do are new plays each season. So, but this is a particular program, I think, that's filling a niche. When you talk to writers around the country, as I do a lot, a lot of them will complain that there are development opportunities. They have an opportunity to hear their plays read. They have an opportunity to get feedback. But what they are missing really is a chance to actually get those plays into production.
I've heard the same thing.
People who complain about plays being, quote, workshopped to death, close quote. And so part of what we're trying to do is address that question. The other sort of impulse behind it was that we, I think that there's a sort of potential challenge or flaw with play development, and that is that plays are being constructed for the development process as opposed to being, sort of constructed for production. That there's so much development that happens that people sort of get in this sort of developmental loop, and they're not able to then sort of break out the play into sort of the next step, which is production. And that a play really only is fully developed when you get it in front of an audience.
That's true. You're saying it's one of those, they get caught in that, like a cat chasing his tail,
exactly,
kind of thing, or a dog,
exactly,
chasing his tail.
And so, you know, you keep doing development, but nobody's actually really testing the ideas that are.
And sometimes they can develop it to the point where it was good, and then they make it bad, right?
And I've seen that happen too. Not here, of course, at Steppenwolf, but certainly, one hears writers talk about that. And so, our philosophy as a producing theater was that plays are meant to be produced, and that what we wanted to do was provide a development opportunity that culminates in production as opposed to just further development.
So you get people submit plays. Tell us let's start the funnel, and then we'll come out with the three plays that you're going to.
The plays that are chosen for the rep, and there are three this year as there were last year, come from our general pool of submissions. The first way that we get scripts is through agents. Agents who represent writers will contact us and inquire about whether we're interested in looking at a particular writer's work or a particular script. And most of the time, we say yes, and those plays come in. And we get about 300 scripts a year through agents and through other professional referrals. People in jobs like mine around the country or artistic directors will contact us and say, hey, we did this play, or we know this writer, or we read this play and we can't do it, but we think it's valuable and maybe you should take a look at it. So we get about 300 plays a year that way. We also get roughly 750 writers a year trying to submit a play to Steppenwolf on their own. Our submission guidelines, which you can find on our website at www.steppenwolf.org, essentially that a writer can send in a 10-page sample of their work and a synopsis and their bio. And we get between 10 and 20 of those every week, and we read them.
You do read them?
We do read them.
Very good.
We read them all.
That says a lot, right?
Yes.
A lot of it that go into the slush pile.
Yes. Now, we read all of the submissions that we get that way, and then we make a decision about whether we're going to look at the full script or not. And as I said, we look at a total of 500 plays every year, so you can figure roughly 15 or 20% of those 750 submissions are called in to look at the full script. So it's, I certainly wouldn't argue that it's an ideal process. I mean, it's hard looking at just 10 pages of a play and deciding if you're really going to look at the full script.
Well, you got to have some sort of a screening, or you'd never ever produce one because you'd be reading one every day.
We have to. We have to. You know, and as it is, we process 500 full plays a year. But, the analogy I usually draw is to when actors audition, you're only seeing, a few minutes of their work. And it's no one, I think, would argue that that's the best way to see somebody's work or the best way to cast. But because of the pragmatics of theater, you kind of have to be able to see a large number of people in a short amount of time. And so that's the way you do it. We feel like this way, at least we're able to give these writers some access. And there are a lot of theaters around the country that, don't even allow that. I mean, very few theaters nowadays especially are able to just take in blind submissions. You have to, pay people to read the plays. You want to behave responsibly and make sure that those plays are getting read by qualified people. And so, our way of trying to make sure that we're really giving the best quality read to a play is to sort of ultimately limit the number of plays that we're looking at every year, so that the plays that we actually are reading are.
Well, that speaks volumes for Steppenwolf and for Chicago, because I understand in New York you can't even get anything read.
Well, it's tough. It's tough. It's tough nationally, and as I said, part of those reasons are economic. I mean, theaters prioritize. Where are you going to spend your money, and are you really going to spend it paying somebody to read 1,000 plays that are coming from writers all over the country or not? For us, as I said, we're certainly, we make a heavy commitment to new play development. It's one of the strong priorities for the theater. But there are even limits to what we can do. And so this is, unfortunately, a way in which we have to limit access. But as I said, for the overwhelming majority of writers, they at least are getting a crack at getting.
They can't ask for anything more.
So, yeah. So there's those two ways, through agents or through the writer sending in a sample. And then another way that plays end up in first look, and that's true of two of the plays this year, are plays that we commission. So
what's criteria for commissioning a play?
Commissioning is first of all, to explain what it is, essentially we are giving the writer some support, that is, some money, to write a play specifically for Steppenwolf. And we get certain rights in the commissioning contract that we get the first writer first refusal to produce the play. So we're giving some writer some support. They're usually coming in with an idea of what the play is going to be, but often not more than that. Sometimes they'll have some sample pages, sometimes they won't. It varies. But for the most part, we're saying this is a writer that we believe in.
So you bet on the writer more than what they're writing about. You don't tell them what to write.
No. So there are theaters that do. I mean, I think our philosophy is that you want a writer to write about what they're most passionate about and what is, you know, as a primary concern to them.
So if they're not known to you, you want a sample of the idea of what they're trying to write.
Yeah, although generally speaking, I mean, we only commission writers that we are either have an ongoing relationship with or, you know, with whom we expect that we're going to continue to have a relationship.
Okay.
I mean, part of what we do with commissioning is saying, you know, here's some support for you. We're investing in you. We want you to think of Steppenwolf as your artistic home. And so we're giving
It's a great policy, and I've been familiar with it, but I know a lot of our listeners aren't aware of that.
Yeah, and we commission, we have under commission between 10 and 12 writers at any given time.
Wow, I didn't know you had that many.
Yeah, it's a significant amount. And that's a pretty nice balance of writers of sort of more national reputation, people like Stephen Dietz or Richard Greenberg, and then also some local writers. I mean, Mia McCullough, who's a local writer,
right,
who's part of the First Look rep this season, is someone who I've known for over 10 years. I actually produced her first play when I was working at another theater as a late night, and sort of we got to know each other through
She's
that.
A real talent, yeah.
Yeah.
And a neat lady. I've interviewed her in the past.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was her play is a play that we commissioned and that we did a couple of readings of and thought, well, the next natural step in its development is to allow it to have actors really investing some time, a director really invest some time, and actually go through a workshop and rehearsal process. And so that's what we're doing with that play.
So the three that you picked, I mean, they come through the funnel, but you're really giving people a lot of chances.
I hope that we are.
You are more than, and I've investigated this.
Yeah.
You certainly much more than most theaters.
Yeah, we certainly try to do that. And you know, it's interesting. I mean, last year we did have a play by Jason Wells called Men of Tortuga, and that was part of last year's First Look rep. And that was a play that came in off a 10-page sample. He sent us 10 pages. We read the 10 pages. We liked it.
You were asking me earlier which play I saw that one. And it was very good.
It's
yes.
Quite a good
and that
play.
Came out of the 10,
yeah.
just out of over the transom, you might
transom,
say.
Over the transom, 10-page sample. We read the full script, got excited about it.
The reason I wanted to bring that up is because, you know, you hear some playwrights whining, and usually people without much talent, but that they don't get a chance to get produced here. And certainly, you guys give them every opportunity.
Well, as I said, we certainly try. I wouldn't say that we're perfect. Nobody is, but we certainly do our best to be as open as we possibly can be.
Okay, so now you've picked the three plays, right?
Right, right.
And is there a committee? Do you pick them, or how?
Well, I have a fair amount of input into the plays. Obviously, Martha Levy, our artistic director, is the person ultimately responsible for all of our programming. So, but usually, I'll give her five or seven scripts that I'm really interested in for the process. We'll talk about them and then try to figure out what's going to be the best match. It's a little bit tricky with First Look Rep, because you're not just sort of programming three plays. We want to take plays that are, we feel, at a point where they're going to really benefit from this kind of process.
So they're still raw.
They're raw, but not so raw that they're not ready to really kind of be rehearsed.
Okay.
So part of that weighs into the mix. It's also true that I know that the plays are going to be in rep, which means essentially that they have a basic set with some modifications for each play.
Because you're using the same space.
But we're using the same space, so they have to be able to, you know, inhabit that space reasonably well. I know that they're going to be in the garage, so they want to be of a certain scale that's going to be appropriate for that. We also have, you know, ultimately, you know, a total limit on the number of characters for the rep as a whole, so I have to kind of juggle, okay, I can't do a 12-character play because that means I'll have to do 2 one-character plays. So, you know, we kind of have to balance out, you know, the number of characters in each play and make sure that all fits into the number of contracts that we have available. So there are a number of pragmatic considerations.
Excuse me, you almost need a math formula for this.
Well, fortunately, you know, I mean, our production manager and our casting director and our general manager, we all, you know, hash out some of these details together.
Okay, so now once the plays are picked, you do expect the playwright to be here in residence to work with you?
Yes, yes, very much so.
I mean, that would be awesome for any playwright to do that.
I think, you know, that's the purpose of the process, okay, is to have the writer in residence and being able to make changes. And what's different, as I said, a little bit of what's different about First Look from a regular, you know, just sort of mounting the premiere of a play. And I should mention that we don't call these plays our productions of them. We don't call this the world premiere. You know, these are developmental productions. It's our hope that the plays will go on and have a future life. It may be that that someone else wants to claim that they're doing the premiere. That happened with Men of Tortuga this year, actually. You know, the play that we did last year in First Look Rep is going to get a production at the Oslo Theater in Florida, very well-respected.
Oh, yes, I know them, yes.
And they are claiming the world premiere. That is, you know, it's as I said, it's part of our philosophy about First Look Rep is that we are doing development on the plays and that the development leads to production, but that's not necessarily the ultimate.
Yeah, because he might have made changes after he did here, right?
Even after here, yeah.
Okay.
So, and it's also, you know, it would certainly be our goal that Steppenwolf or other theaters are going to produce these plays after they're finished in the First Look Rep. So that's why we continue to call them developmental productions as opposed to world premieres.
That's a good distinction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was going to ask you that. Okay, so now the process starts.
Yes.
And are they involved with everything from casting to tell me what the playwright's involved with? I mean, besides hearing, you know, when actors are speaking his words, right, some lines work, some don't.
Right, right, right.
And he gets feedback from the directors and everyone involved, right?
Correct, correct, correct. That, you know, generally, actually, even before we get into rehearsal, there's a meeting with the director and the playwright and the dramaturg and me, and we talk about what we think the strengths and weaknesses of the play are, what the playwright is trying to achieve, how far along they think they are in trying to achieve it, just so everybody really is on the same page at the start of the process so that the writer can both get reflected back what is in the play and also that they can give some sense of what it is that they're actually trying to accomplish. And then, you know, based on that meeting and conversations and usually some subsequent conversations with the writer, we kind of plot out a strategy for making revisions during the process and with enough flexibility that other things that come up while they're rehearsing the play may be able to be accommodated.
I wonder how intimidating that is for the writers because, you know, I've run across writers who are married to every word, and it's like you got to wrestle them to the ground to change a comma.
Yeah.
How does that work? I mean, it is intimidating. If I was coming in, even though I know some of you guys, it would be intimidating coming to Steppenwolf with this world-class theater and having these top directors, you know, telling you that line doesn't work or this character is incomplete or whatever.
Right. Well, we try to make this as, you know, as friendly and accommodating, a place for writers and a positive environment for writers possibly can. And actually, I mean, most of the time I try to have the conversation start not with the director talking and giving notes, but with the playwright talking about what they feel the strengths and weaknesses are. And that often sets the tone, I think, for the whole process, that while the director obviously has to ultimately be responsible for the product on stage, this is a process where the writer is heavily engaged and has a great deal of authority in the room.
But he has to understand it's a creative process.
Absolutely.
And there's nothing like blunt honesty. And at this point, when there's only a few of you in a room, that's the time to tell him what works and what doesn't work, right?
Yeah. Well, but sometimes you don't know, Tom. And that's kind of what's interesting. And in fact, that's, again, part of the purpose of the whole process. I mean, I've read literally thousands of plays, and yet I don't think I think I would be wrong to say that works and that doesn't definitively. without actually hearing actors read it and seeing it in front of people.
So you always keep an open mind, then, even if you have a little question mark or whatever.
Which is not to say that you can't make progress. I mean, you know, I think oftentimes one has a pretty good idea of whether something's going to work or not and why it's going to work. But again, part of the workshop and rehearsal process here is testing that stuff out. And so a writer may come in saying, you know, I think this monologue doesn't really work, and I don't quite know why. Well, part of the process can be, you know, having an actor read it, having some conversation, letting the actor talk about it, letting the director talk about it, and all of that input informing some changes that may get made and help the playwright feel that the monologue is working.
Well, in doing my research, you got to tell the Mammoth story about his play and when he got rejected. You got to throw that in for it, because that was terrific.
Yeah, that was David Mamet, you know, had written, who was an relatively unknown writer at the time, had sent around this play called Glengarry Glen Ross, strange, cumbersome, you know, title, and had been rejected universally, like throughout the country, everywhere. And he had gotten to know Harold Pinter in some way, and he sent it to Harold Pinter off in England, and he wrote Harold a note saying, you know, dear Mr. Pinter, you know, here's my play, can you, you know, please tell me what's wrong with it? And Pinter wrote him back and said, nothing, the only thing you need is a production. And he gave it to the National Theater, and the National Theater produced it, and of course it went off to win the Pulitzer and all that stuff. So it was a case where you know, a writer, I think, had a pretty good sense that the play was working, and what it really needed was to be up in front of an audience. And they certainly made revisions during the National Theater process and beyond, but the advantage, I think, for David Mamet in that case was somebody's really making a leap and saying, we're going to get this play into some rehearsal and get it up in front of an audience.
That's a great story, and obviously that kind of sums up what your program is really all about. You're giving people that opportunity to have this. Okay, so now we're into we've done readings,
right,
and you've given your input, and
right,
your director. At that point,
right,
you assign a director. You have a director.
Yes, we often will send the script to a director that we think is right for the project. You know, in this case, with First Look Rep, we've got three fantastic directors. Lisa Portes is directing Mia McCullough's play. Lisa actually directed a reading of Spare Change, of Mia's play, last year.
Yeah, that's a good time to go in. Can bring in each play as part of this story.
Sure.
And Mia McCullough's play is
Spare Change,
right?
Yeah, Spare Change.
Give us the premise of that, because I think it's an interesting idea.
It's about an upper-middle-class couple, and the husband is on the L. It's set in Chicago, and the husband's on the L, and he has a chance meeting with a homeless woman. And because of sort of what that meeting with her trips off in him emotionally, he ends up going on a kind of reevaluation of his life, of the choices that he's made, both in terms of his marriage and also in terms of his profession. And it really sends him into a bit of a tailspin.
Interesting premise.
Yeah. So the play is a very funny play, and has a great deal of humor in it. But it's, you know, it's kind of going after largely, you know, people like us. I mean, sort of, you know, upper middle class people, you know, who reach a certain point in their lives and realize, well, wait a minute, are the choices that I've made really the ones that I ought to have made?
So it's a comedy, but it's got a good message to it.
It has a message to it, yes.
And so tell us about the director
Lisa Portes will be directing. Lisa recently directed, I know, Permanent Collection up at Northlight Theater.
Yes, it was very good.
And I also know her as a teacher. She is the head of the directing program at DePaul. And has done a fair amount of new work, and she did a lot of new work in New York when she was based there, and now she is here living in Chicago. And she is a wonderfully passionate, vibrant director with a really strong visual sense, and I think takes great care of writers and the actors in the room. As I said, she directed a reading of this play. One of the things that we do, in addition to the plays that are being produced in the rep, we also have some other events that are intended to showcase the development of new work. One of those is that on the Saturdays during the rep, we have readings of other plays, new plays that were.
Yeah, and that's on the Steppenwolf website too, because you will have readings coming up of plays that
are just in development.
They're in the real early stage.
Correct.
So besides these I don't know what we call them, semi finished or remountable.
Right.
Presentable plays.
Right,
I won't call them world premieres.
No, great.
Okay. that you have the really raw first step.
Right, right.
And people can come and see those readings too.
Yeah, yeah. And so last year we did a reading of Mia's play and Lisa directed it, and they seemed like a great team, and so she was a natural person to go to. I think she felt a real affinity for the piece, and they're off and running with it.
Great. Tell us about the other two plays.
Yes, there's Marissa Wegerzin.
I'm glad you said that, because that's Wegerzin.
Yes, Marissa Wegerzin.
Wegerzin.
She's a young writer who I actually got to know because she was a student of someone whom I knew when she was at the Washington University of St. Louis and was moving to Chicago. And this colleague called me and said, there's this young writer coming up. She's just graduated, and you should take a look at her stuff. So we did, got excited about it, I read a couple of her plays, and then we commissioned her to write a play. So there's a case of a writer, young local writer, who we wanted to support, who had not really had a play produced in Chicago before, in fact, really had only had productions predominantly at the university that she was attending, and this was a chance for us to say, this is a writer that we think is really worthy, this is a writer that people should be paying attention to, and it's someone that we want to have a relationship with and we want to create a relationship with, and so we commissioned her to write a play. Again, with Marissa, she came with a couple of different ideas about what the play might be, and we kind of looked at the three of them and chose one, and then she wrote a totally different play.
Wow.
Which is just fine, because the play that she's written is terrific, I think. And, of course, we were in dialogue about it. I mean, she after the first meeting that we had, and she said, I gave you that list, and I think I might want to try something else. We talked about it.
It's also showing flexibility and trust.
Yes.
She just went right at it.
Well,
wow.
Our philosophy here is, you have to trust the artist. I mean, that's all what we're about. I mean, from the top down, that informs all of our production choices. It informs our programming. It informs, I think, our whole aesthetic, is that there's a great deal of trust in the artist's voice.
It's got to be exciting that when you tell her, you mention something, and then she goes off and boom, the spark gets lit. That's got to be exciting.
It was. And certainly, great days in my job. A lot of the time I spend having to tell writers, I'm sorry, we're not doing your play. I mean, we get 500 plays a year. We're going to do maybe 5 new plays every year. And so a lot of what I do is having to tell writers, I'm sorry, no. The excitement of being able to tell a writer, we'd like to commission you, or we're going to do your play, those are great days for me, absolutely great days. So Marissa's,
tell us what her it's The Butcher of Baraboo?
The Butcher of Baraboo, yep. And it's set in a small town in the upper Midwest. It's a sort of dark comedy about this family. The family patriarch has gone missing, and so the mother and daughter are left there to kind of fend on their own. It's kind of a mystery.
Oh, okay. Everyone loves a good mystery.
Yeah. What's happened to the father, and how that consequences of what's happened to the father are going to play out in the family dynamic.
And it's directed by Dexter Bullard.
Dexter Bullard, yeah. A lot of people may know Dexter. He directed Grace up at Northlight.
Yes, he did. That was awesome.
Yeah,
yes.
Terrific, terrific production. He's also the director of a Tracy Letts play called Bug that ran at Red Orchid and then ran at the Barrow Street Theater off Broadway. And he also, by coincidence, is on faculty at DePaul as well. So Dexter, I think, has absolutely the right sensibility. There's darkly comic violence in Butcher of Baraboo.
Darkly comic violence.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, akin. I mean, if people are familiar, perhaps, with the work of Martin McDonagh, like The Beauty
yes,
of
I Man, love Martin McDonagh.
Or,
yes.
Or The Lonesome West, or Skull and Kinnamara. Marissa is a very American writer, but her sensibility, her quirky sense of humor, her sort of darkness, her imagery, is you know, has a little bit of an undertone of some violence to it.
Okay.
And so Dexter, I think, is a perfect.
And I see you got John Judd and Annabelle Armour. There's two of the best in town.
Yeah, two terrific actors. Annabelle, in fact, is back for the second year. She was in Joel Johnson's play, A Blameless Life, last year as part of First Look Rep, and she enjoyed the process so much that she was really lobbying to come back.
Says a lot for Steppenwolf, the kind of people you have. I mean, I was looking at your next play, Marianne Thebus and John Hogenacker, among others.
Yes.
I mean, wow.
The
casting. I mean, you're just not bringing in young student actors. You've hired top pros to do these shows.
Yeah, well, and again, part of that, I think, is a tribute to the quality of the writing of these plays. I mean, all three of these plays are plays that attract actors of very high caliber, and I think it's also a testament to their interest in new play work and a testament to the investment that they want to make.
Two of them I know on this list do a lot of teaching of acting too. Marianne Thebus,
yes,
and Annabelle Armour. I know them, both of them are acting instructors and teachers. So,
yes, that's right.
So as a playwright, you get a top director, you get top actors, and they certainly know their craft.
That's
terrific. Any playwright, I would think, would almost want to kill to get in this program.
Well, it's...
you got to learn. It's not about what you get, it's what you become, right?
Right. And the third play, as you're mentioning, Marianne Thebus is in, and that's a play called 100 Saints You Should Know by Kate Fodor. People may remember Kate as the author of a play called Hannah and Martin, which was
one of the best plays of the year a couple years ago, yes.
Really terrific piece. And this is really only her second play. Her agent sent it over to us. We read it, got really excited about it. We sent it to BJ because we thought with his
BJ Jones, right, from Northlight.
Correct, from artistic director at Northlight, that he would really be excited, that the material would resonate with him very much personally. And it did, and he jumped on board. So,
what's the premise of this play?
That play is about a wayward priest. Is there any other kind in drama? Probably not.
Yeah, that's true.
But he's left his parish under somewhat mysterious circumstances, and the woman who was his cleaning woman at the parish follows him out to his mother's house where he's been staying. Without divulging too much more of the plot, just say I think that, the play, in some ways is, concerns issues of faith and love and how, the choices that we make, may be reflective of what we have faith in.
This is a drama.
And this is, it's a drama, it's a fairly seriously minded piece, but there's a great deal of humor. There's two younger characters, a young girl and a young boy, who provide a lot of the play's sort of humor, but it's a piece that's a serious, thought-provoking, I think very deeply felt and moving piece of work. So it's quite a nice play, and we're I think making great progress on it in the process.
Okay, time for a little commercial for these plays. The one thing I'd point out is these are each $15.
Yes.
And you can get a first look pass to all three for $30.
That's correct.
Folks, the only thing I can tell you is, with the price of theater in Chicago, you will not be able to go anywhere and see professionally done plays with equity actors for $15.
Yeah.
So this has got to be underwritten somewhere or another.
Well, no, it's part of our commitment. I mean, that's true of all of the plays in our garage are priced at $15. And that's at least in part because, we feel giving that kind of access to the work, and particularly to new work, is really important. People feeling like they're getting good value for their money. Look, we want to attract, certainly theater lovers and people who are adventurous into this kind of work. These are new plays, so people who are excited about being there when something is born, I think, are the kind of...
Yeah, that's exciting. And I know as a reviewer, I love to see these new things. And folks, I can tell you, I've seen almost everything you guys have done the last 5 years, particularly in the garage theater and the upstairs. What some people say, well, that's their second level. No, that's just at a different location. It's all on one level, and it's top-notch.
I think so. And again, if you look at the list of actors and the creative people involved in the First Look Rep, I mean, yes, these are people who worked on at the major theaters around town, and certainly worked on our big stages. So, yeah, it's again, I think goes back to, you know, this is a real commitment from the theater. We are deeply committed to promoting new work and developing new work, and we believe it should get a full investment, and that's why we try to bring in the highest caliber people that we can to work on it and provide it at an affordable price.
Well, it certainly is, and they're going to start July 20th, right? The Saints.
Yep.
Starts July 20th, and you rotate them each day, right? And
then yes, it's a traditional, actual rotating rep, which also is a little bit unusual these days.
Yes, it is.
But yes, you can see one play on Saturday afternoon, a different play on Saturday night, and a third play on Sunday. You can see all three plays in one weekend, and make a whole event of it.
And it goes from July 20th to
August 13th.
August 13th. Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's a short window, but
yeah, each play only gets 6 or 7 performances. Last year, experience was that the tickets went quite quickly. We ended up adding one performance of Men of Tortuga because of popular demand, but we don't have that much room in the schedule to be able to do that. It's only an 80 seat house, so you're seeing these new plays
if they get the three play one, you know how to figure that out so they can. How do they know when to go?
Oh, well,
yeah, if they buy that pass, because that's the way to do it.
Yeah, the three play package, you can basically attend any performance of the three shows, but you schedule them when you purchase your packet.
Okay.
So if you buy the package of three tickets, you don't only have to go on one.
And what's the phone number that they can call to get tickets?
Oh, see, now you're testing things like our box office number, which I
all right, I have notes here. Let me see if I can come up with it. Yes, audience services, 312-335-1650. Once more, 312-335-1650. Okay, now, there is another part of this program that we got to mention, the First Look 101.
Yes.
Tell us about that. Okay. That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's something that we've expanded for this year. It began last year with something we called the First Look Council, which was a group of about 20 or 30 people. Mainly members of our board of trustees, our director's circle, other people who had shown support and interest in new work. And we invited them in to various points in the new play development process for these three plays. And that was met with such enthusiasm.
So they can sit like a fly on the wall.
Fly on the wall.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
And so we've expanded it this year. We've allowed 101 people to sign up for this experience. And what they do is there's a sequence of events that they attend that are the actual events. In other words, we don't program these events specifically as a sort of dog and pony show, but rather we're giving these First Look 101ers access to the actual process of what we do.
So even if they weren't going to come, you would do all whatever.
Correct. We would do what we're doing.
So they get a chance to really kind of sneak in and
see what's there. As you say, a fly on the wall and really see what we do. So they come and they hear just an unrehearsed sit-down reading by actors of the play, of a draft of the play. Then they come to the first day of rehearsal. So they get to hear some of the changes that may have happened between the initial reading and the first day.
So you have your 101 for this year.
We have 101 for this year. Yes.
How is that going? You getting? Do you quietly talk to them on the side to get any feedback?
Excuse me. We do have discussion sessions usually after events that they attend,
okay,
so that they have a chance to talk with me or with other members of our staff, or with the creative team. On a particular show to talk about what they've been seeing. But the idea was to create a certain amount of transparency into the new play process. There was an article that Ben Cameron, who until recently was the head of Theater Communications Group in New York, and he wrote an article a couple of years ago about the way in which arts institutions and theaters in particular seemed to feel that it was necessary to maintain a certain level of mystery about what we do. And he drew the analogy to sports teams, where real aficionados of the game can go and watch batting practice and then go and watch the players playing the game. And that he sort of labeled this idea transparency. And so one of the things that we started thinking about here was, what are the ways in which we can create a greater transparency in what we do? And this seemed a really perfect project for doing that. So
particularly, though, for someone who is thinking about becoming a playwright. who has interest in, or right?
I mean, sure, yeah. I mean, it's certainly for, I mean, people who are interested as writers, it's a great way to see, you know, what the play development process is like.
But even if you're just a patron, that's...
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, that, you know, the our most, you know, the most success we've had are with people who are what we would call our heavy users. I mean, people who are subscribers, mm-hmm. people who are really excited about coming to the theater and want to find out more about how you know, a play actually gets put together. And so, and looking at a new play, it offers in some ways a kind of extended process, and so we're able to really give access. So
can a documentary be far away?
Well, maybe not. I don't know. At this point, what we're interested in is really engaging with our audience and in deepening the conversation that they can have with us, and I think allowing people access to what we do and giving them an understanding of what it really takes to develop a new play and what it takes to get a production actually mounted. I mean, I think it makes for a richer, deeper, more interesting experience for them.
Yes, I could see that. Yeah. That's a terrific idea.
I, again, the analogy I often draw is to think about, well, I loved going to museums, but once I took an art history class, you know, and started to understand exactly, you know, why it is that painters or sculptors work in the way that they do and why they make certain choices, I gained a much greater appreciation for the art that I was
looking at. I agree. The more you know the technical ends. Like I had the honor one time of seeing one of the Broadway shows from backstage, and it was a full major. I can't say which one it was, but it's a totally different show.
Amazing,
and you understand why the prices are what they are, because there's so many people, you know, get them in the costume, and everything worked that day. Everything worked flawlessly. To me, it was chaos, but this was an easy show.
Yes.
So anyone getting that understanding, you just appreciate the art form.
Yeah, I certainly think so. And it gives close contact, I think, for people with the artists, and they may not always get a chance to do that.
So it's filled this year. When could someone enroll if they wanted to for next year?
Usually it's, at least in the last 2 years now, we've, started the process sometime in January, February. So, sometime in February, there will start to be information on our website.
Okay.
We usually send out an email
to our subscription. That's cool. And if you could make sure that I get that, we'll put it in our news portion.
Oh, that'd be great.
People can do it for the Talk Theater in Chicago, because we're always looking for stuff like that.
Right.
And, again, the people who listen are theater people are interested in, so I think they would meet your criteria.
Yeah.
Wow. This has been terrific. So people should come see this show.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope people will come see all three. That's part of the point of it, is to get people in and get the work exposed and get some response. So.
Well, you've got three top writers with three interesting premises, and the price is right. It's summer. There's not a lot of shows going on.
I mean,
there couldn't be a better time. I'm looking forward. I'm going to do – you have the one day for us and for others that – you can do all three on the Sunday.
Right. That's
I'm
right.
a glutton. So, I've got to see all three.
I think it's a great way to do it. Yeah.
And thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Tom. Pleasure talking to you.
Well, and I think people now understand the process more. And you come see these shows, you'll see why Steppenwolf is a world-class theater group.
Great.
Thank you, Ed.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for listening to this exorable episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast, brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. But, of course, before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote has to deal with writing, and it comes from The Twelfth Night, Act 3, Scene 2. Let there be gall enough in thy ink. And again, we can't thank you enough for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your head. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.